Blog Talk Radio.
Buenos noches, depending on where you are, and welcome, one and all, to America's Deadly Sins. My name is Christopher Bruce, and I write a blog entitled, America's Deadly Sins, and it's a blog about what is wrong with our country, what we can do to fix it, if that's even remotely possible anymore, and what'll happen if we don't, which, by the way, is on its way with a vengeance. Our time as a formerly free and sovereign nation is more than over. And our propensity to keep our heads buried firmly up our butts is nothing short of utter insanity. So the purpose of this broadcast will be to wake your sorry asses up. So pay attention. Oh, and one more thing. If you came here thinking this would be the one place you'd be safe from being offended, get out. Because it's my full intention to offend you. If you don't get offended by the end of the show, just pull a number, have a seat, and I'll get right to you as soon as possible. All right, listen up. Guys, how can you still be asleep? I don't understand it. I really don't. Yeah, sure. I was a good little sheep once. Yeah, I was just as asleep. Okay, let's be honest. But thanks to a big kick in the shins by government, well, here I am, folks. And there ain't no bigger kick in the shins than somebody messing with your family that belongs to government. But we won't talk about that right now because that's not what this show is all about. Okay, on to the rant, shall we? Guys, I discovered a document this morning that I'm just going to say that if you've been asleep, you just got to remember that these people are telling you everything that you want to know. They may not put it right out there in public, but by God, they put it out. You can look on in the UN agendas. You can look on the congressional record. It's all right there. They tell you exactly what they want to do. And one of the biggest things they want to do is kill the majority of us. Now, you may think that's bullcrap, but they tell you. They tell you. They put it right out there. Now, I've got in my hand a little document. It's called the Rockefeller's document. And you guys, I want to go ahead and just ramble something off real quick. This is something I just shared on Facebook. I thought I had it right up there. I guess I don't. Okay, for those of you that do not believe that the cabal is responsible for every problem this country and the world has today, know this. First, that the people that originally paid to make popular our current healthcare system that makes this country, big pharma, cancer research, etc., billions of dollars, were the Rockefellers and Carnegie, the same people that graced us with our current worthless money and the Fed. Thank the Rockefellers, everyone. These faces, my friends, are the people responsible for the success of big pharma and the entire searching for the cure cancer industry, which, by the way, is bull crap. They would never search for the cure because that doesn't make them any money. Real cures for cancer have popped up over the decades, and they're all natural, and they are downplayed by the AMA and called quackery. Stop trusting doctors, the real quacks of the AMA. They are only drug pushers and recommend you surgery you don't need. Keep diabetics on their drugs all their lives when natural cures have been found that are inexpensive and that can even reverse type 2. All disease, including cancer, can be cured naturally from God's green earth all day, every day. Rid yourselves of the descendants of these people, and you rid yourselves of every issue that we have. Now, these people have put out a wonderful little document that I like to call
the interstitial banking system.
Oh, I am so sorry. Hang on just a second, please. Jeez. Okay, go ahead. That's all I got to say about the matter. We're going to, you know, I've just never figured out a quick way to navigate in this program. Scenarios for the future of technology and international development. Now, guys, they can say scenarios all they like, but these are actual plans that these people have. All right. Now we're going to go over a little plan they like to call lockstep. All right. Now, here it goes right here. They have headlines in lockstep. 2010, quarantine restricts in-person contact, cellular networks are overloaded. 2015, intercontinental trade hit by strict pathogen controls. 2017, Italy addresses immigrant caregiver gaps with robots. 2020, will Africa embrace of authoritarian capitalism a la China continue? Vietnam to require a solar panel in every home, 2022. I mean, these are plans, folks. Proliferating trade networks in Eastern and Southern Africa strengthen regional ties. And 2028, African leaders fear repeat of Nigeria's 2026 government collapse, 2028. Now, I'm going to go on to page 18 here because this is probably the most important part of this document. And I want you guys to hear this because it has to do very much so with the pandemic that we're currently experiencing. These are scenario narratives, okay? Lockstep is a world of tighter top-down government control and more authoritarian leadership with limited innovation and growing citizen pushback. See, they're purposely making things hard for you so that you'll push back. And when you do push back, well, they've got a way to handle the situation. In 2012, the pandemic that the world had been anticipating for years finally hit. Unlike 2009's H1N1, this new influenza strain originating from wild geese was extremely virulent and deadly. Even the most pandemic-prepared nations were quickly overwhelmed when the virus streaked around the world, infecting nearly 20% of the global population and killing off 8 million in just 7 months, the majority of them healthy young adults. The pandemic also had a deadly effect on economics. International mobility of both people and goods screeched to a halt, debilitating industries like tourism and breaking global supply chains. Even locally, normally bustling shops and office buildings sat empty for months, devoid of both employees and customers. The pandemic blanketed the earth. Through disproportionate numbers died in Africa, Southeast Asia, and Central America, where the virus spread like wildfire in the absence of official containment protocols. But even in developed countries, containment was a challenge. The United States' initial policy is strongly discouraging citizens from flying, proved deadly in its leniency, accelerating the spread of the virus not just within the U.S. but across borders. However, a few countries did fare better, China in particular.
the Chinese government's quick imposition and enforcement of mandatory quarantine for all citizens, as well as its instant and near hermetic sealing off of all borders, saved millions of lives, stopping the spread of the virus far earlier than in other countries and enabling a swifter post-pandemic recovery. China's government was not the only one that took extreme measures to protect its citizens from risk and exposure. During the pandemic, national leaders around the world flexed their authority and imposed airtight rules and restrictions, from the mandatory wearing of face masks to body temperature checks at the entries to communal spaces like train stations and supermarkets. Even after the pandemic faded, this more authoritarian control and oversight of citizens and their activities stuck and even intensified. In order to protect themselves from the spread of increasingly global problems, from pandemics and transnational terrorism to environmental crises and rising poverty, leaders around the world took a firmer grip on power. See, this is how they handle it, folks. What they're going to do is just leak out these little viruses, and they're going to cause all these countries to strengthen their hold on the people. And this is how they're going to do this. Okay, you know, if you can't see it in black and white, then what the hell good are you? Most people are asleep and they like it there. You know, I think back to the Matrix movie where that guy said, just put me back in, man. I miss the taste, the steaks. And I mean, I'm like, are you crazy? Anyway, we are here today to talk about banking. Now, we have a guest tonight. She's somewhere around here. Let's see her somewhere. Oh, there she is. Well, anyway, she's here waiting for us. And what we're going to be talking about today is how the banking system works, how everything works. We want to Miss Gross, who we have today. She's a podcaster from California. She's written 3 books. She's an author. Pretty good gal, all in all. Don't ask me why I think that, but I certainly do. And I do have some documents that are up in front of me on how banks work, but, you know, because this is one of the things it just makes me sick, because I know how they work, and I know how this whole system works. One thing I'm just going to bring in before I bring Linda in is this. Money is illusory, okay? It's illusory. Who needs it? Who needs it? I don't need it. But see, I wanted to dig up something on the history of currency, because currencies, paper currencies that are backed by nothing, fail. And then so do the governments in which those people are. Now, all you got to remember is this. Some guy somewhere who produces this currency for you that is backed by absolutely nothing, folks, all that person has to do is say, hey, guess what? Your money is worthless, and it's worthless. The only reason that money is able to have any power whatsoever is because some guy said somewhere that it was worth something. The $100 bill isn't printed with special paper. It doesn't have golden ink, okay? It costs just as much money to make a $1 bill as it does a $100 bill. It's the same worthless stuff, folks. It's just paper. It has no intrinsic value of its own. It's not backed by a damn thing. Hasn't been backed by anything since 1933. I believe Nixon actually had the last of it. That was silver-backed stuff. But it's gone. The gold standard has been abolished. That means your money is worthless. And this privatized bank that has been printing things ever since, you know, it's paper, folks. It's not worth anything. And when you finally figure out, not that you really want to know, but when you finally figure out how the banking system works and how money works, you'd think to yourself, what is this? I mean, why do I have this? And you're working like a dog for it. That's the other thing. You're working like a dog for it, and it's worth nothing, just like your things. I'm going to go ahead and bring her in. Linda Gross from California, you are. No, that was a big trick. I am so sorry, guys. I pressed the wrong button. I put myself on mute.
All right.
Hang on just a second. Linda Gross, you are with us, are you not?
I am here in the flesh. How are you, Christopher?
Thank God for that, because I was worried about myself for a minute. I am so happy to hear you. Tell these people a little bit about yourself. Tell them what you do and what you're about.
I write about dating and relationships. And as you mentioned, I have a podcast that I do weekly. It's called The Men's Advocate Show, The Men's Advocate Show. So people can tune in. Usually I'm around on Tuesday afternoons, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. And you can also check out my books. So for the men, I have my readers tell me that this is the absolute Bible for men. It tells you anything and everything you need to know about women. In fact, a lot of my readers tell me they take a yellow highlighter and read it 2, 3, and 4, 5 times. And the reason why they do that is they highlight certain areas and come back to it again and again. And you can implement the tactics in my book pretty much on any level. I mean, the book was intended for a relationship level, but my readers tell me they use it on that female coworker or that female boss, or they use it in business to win over a female client. They use it on that pesky neighbor that they just can't get along with. It has applications everywhere. So what I've done is I've done years and years of academic research, and then I combined that with interviewing over 20,000 men to find out what are their issues, what are their roadblocks, and then through the book, systematically, I address what those roadblocks are and how to solve them. So I've boiled down my academic research that we all have core drives. These are certain drives that motivate us, that drive us. So for women, this book, by the way, it's called The Science of Mastering Women, The Real Truth About Women That Will Change Your Life Forever, The Science of Mastering Women. Anyway, I boiled it down in the men's book to 4 traits. Now, these are not traits that you would automatically think of, but once you read them, you're going to just do a head smack on just how easy it is to implement. I know a lot of guys sweat over the relationship issue and, you know, how am I going to win her over? And I'm so nervous and, oh, I think she's so beautiful. What am I going to say? They get tongue-tied. They don't know what they're doing. I know a lot of guys are maybe entering the dating scene, or maybe they are re-entering. Maybe they're widowed, or maybe they got a divorce and all the rules have changed. So they need a set of rules that will work. So it's my contention that if you do the following 4 things, I boiled it down, made it easy for you guys, only 4 things, you can win over any woman anywhere, anytime. It doesn't matter geography, religion, like whatever, because these are inherent biological traits that drive women. So as long as you press those buttons, you're going to be in. So it's as simple as that. And conversely,
well, I'm so glad I never needed you, Linda.
I know.
I'm so glad I never needed you. I'm actually married now, so I don't really need to worry about that crap anymore. But believe me, I didn't have any problems.
Nice.
But anyway, we're not going to talk about that either. Now,
well, hopefully your readers.
Well, one thing I am going to do, I'm going to do a little something at the end for you. I'm going to do a little something at the end that I saved just for you. I wanted to bring it up,
yeah.
And we're going to talk about that later. But anyway, right now we're going to talk about banks. Now, I'm going to start out by relating to people approximately how the banking system works. Now, and then I'm going to talk to you because you have experience as a mortgage broker. Is that correct?
Yes, I was a mortgage broker for many years.
And what bank was that, do you know?
I was a mortgage broker.
Tell me it wasn't
broker,
Wells
so
Fargo.
Represented, no, thank God, not Wells Fargo. But I was a broker, so I represented quite a few banks, of course, among them Countrywide with the big 2008 debacle and everything else.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, a customer would come to me. They would want to buy a house or refinance their existing house, and then I would what's called shop the loan, and I would find them the best deal that fit their circumstances.
Gotcha. Well, then you weren't in the in the nasty portion of it. Then you were just basically trying to make people's lives easier, and I appreciate that. Now, how this is how banks work. Now, I'm just going to give us a little history here. This is how banks work. According to Simple.com, banks work by paying its customers to lend them money. So basically, I'm not sure exactly how that sentence works, because they work by paying their customers to lend them money. Why do you pay somebody to lend you money? I don't know. When a person deposits
back in the day, they paid depositors back in the day, and those numbers were anywhere, like from the 1980s and so forth, they were anywhere from 4% to 16%. So a customer would come in and say, here's my $100 or here's my $1,000 or whatever denomination it was, and the bank would take your money and pay you interest, right? Interest on your money. That was back in the day. Now they pay you nothing. It's like a fraction of 1%. So it's not you can't even really say they're paying you, because by the time you add it all up, it's basically nothing. So you put your money in there, but they're getting the use of your money without having to pay you.
Right, exactly.
Which is not fair.
No, I'm just going to tell it like these people are telling it. Banks work by paying its customers to lend them money. When a person deposits money into their bank account, the bank can then lend other people that money. So they don't even use their own money to lend people money. The depositing customer gains a small amount of money in return, interest on savings, and the lending customer pays a larger amount of money to the bank in return, interest on loans. To make money for itself, the bank keeps the difference. It can be quite difficult to understand banking, since banks are very different from most other businesses. For one thing, they're highly leveraged, with more than $20 in debt for every $1 of equity. Also, it can be hard to understand what banks actually do, since they don't make any real products. And a lot of people seem to think that banking is free, probably because banks keep advertising free checking accounts, free direct deposit, free bill payment, etc. The 363 rule. To fully understand how banks in the U.S. make money, you need to understand a little about the history of banking in the U.S. Traditionally, banks made money by borrowing from depositors at low interest rates, lending that money at higher interest rates to borrowers, and pocketing the difference. Banking used to be heavily regulated, and the joke was that it was a 363 business. Borrow money at 3%, lend it at 6%, and be at the golf course by 3 p.m. Most banks also charged a monthly fee to customers for maintaining a basic account, but most daily transactions were free. But overall, fees were low, constituting only 30% of total revenues. Now, the impact of deregulation, the wave of deregulation beginning in the late 70s, changed this relationship. Main Street companies discovered that they could borrow from the bond markets more cheaply than they could from banks, putting the sixth part of the 363 model under pressure. And lots of new consumer products, such as interest-bearing checking, credit cards, money market accounts, home equity loans, student loans, etc., became available. Banking became a lot more complicated, so bankers couldn't just head to the golf course at 3 p.m. They actually had to work for their money. Two things ended up happening. Banks realized that the bigger they were, the more loans they could make. With deregulation, the big banks grew even bigger by acquiring small banks. Banks also realized that the easiest way to make more money was to simply charge consumers more fees. In fact, the best way to make money was to call a product free by eliminating any monthly fees and then charging lots of fees on transactions. How banks make money. As we explained to Mike, there are three main sources of revenue in retail banking today. Net interest margin. This is the difference, or net, between the interest paid to depositors and the interest received from borrowers. At the moment, the Fed's low interest rate policy means that depositors get almost no money for their savings, and bank margins are huge. Many large banks are making margins over 4% at the moment, which are even higher than the 3% from the good old days of the 363 rule. Number two, we have interchange. Every time you swipe a card at the store, the merchant pays a small percentage of the money to the bank that issued the card, called an interchange fee. For credit cards, this is around 1.7%, while for debit cards, it is near to 1.1%. Given that Americans spend more than they save, it is a huge revenue stream for banks. Last, we have fees. These are the fees that your bank charges you, including ATM fees, overdraft fees, late payment fees, penalty fees, etc. The average household in the U.S. ends up paying over $200 annually in overdraft and bounce check fees alone. Along with interchange, these fees add up to more than 50% of revenue for large banks. It's important to understand that all of this revenue is a real cost to the customer. Some of it may be an explicit cost when it's a fee that shows up on your statement, but even the implicit costs of interchange and net interest margin are real. After all, the merchants pass the cost of interchange on to the consumers in the form of higher prices. And you could be making 3% on your money by buying treasury bonds, which are safer than any bank. By leaving it in the bank at a lower interest rate, you are effectively paying the bank to hold on to your money. And now, for those of you, I'd like to tell you that one time I had a bank account at Wells Fargo. Now, you guys all know, I'm sure all of you know, the nightmare of banking with Wells Fargo. And I'm just going to tell you that I had $240,000 in that bank at one time. And I ran into some bad deals and some bad issues. And what ended up happening is I got that $240,000 down to almost nothing. And I had paid off a bunch of bills. And one payment I had made was $1.25 over what I had in the bank. I had not carried a one or something. I don't know what it was. But essentially what ended up happening is they kept running that payment through. And every time they ran it through, $35, $35, $35. And they did 12 of them in a two-day period. Now, I ended up with 12 overdraft fees of $35. I called that bank and I said, what the hell is this all about? Why are you guys doing this to me? It was $1.25. And they said, now, if you want to do this to me, then I'm going to take all my, you know, what I have left, and I'm just going to close this account. Well, they said, well, we'll take two payments off for you. And I was like, are you serious? And now here's the funny part of that. By the end of the day, they had taken off that two overdrafts, and they had charged it four more times. And I'm like, okay, that's it. I called them up and I said, you assholes, you better take that $212 and just shove it up your butt. And I closed that account and I said, you'll never see that money. So, yeah. So if that doesn't tell you exactly how these people make money, well, nothing does. But go ahead. Now,
Your article writer didn't write about what's called float, which is a very big moneymaker for banks. So what that means is, let's say I deposit your check. We trade services somehow, and I deposit your check of $5,000, or it could be $10, whatever the number is. So the bank penalizes you because I made that deposit after 2 p.m. Eastern time, which is when – 2 p.m. Pacific time, which is 5 p.m. Eastern time. If I made the transaction after the close of the banking business day, they penalize me and they hold that money for 3 days. It doesn't go into my account until, let's say we did this on Monday after 2 p.m. Pacific. It would not go into my account until Thursday morning. So that money is called float. They have access to the $5,000. They can use the $5,000 immediately because guess what? They've withdrawn it from your account, Christopher, immediately, right? They just haven't deposited it yet to my account. So, yeah, that's a huge source of revenue for the banks.
Now, I'm going to tell you that I'm a huge believer in the alternative of credit unions. And credit unions are definitely a nice alternative. But there are some problems with credit unions as well. Now, let me tell you about what happened to me on the credit union side. My family has had a credit union account, the same credit union for probably, I don't know, probably 30, 40 years. And this same credit union, my brother, I had just inherited a bunch of money. And my brother said, why don't you put it in this bank? And I said, well, sure. Well, in this credit union, I said, sure, I'll be glad to do that. They gave me a restricted account. Let me tell you why they did this, because my credit score sucks. Well, you know, to be honest with you, my credit score has always sucked because I don't play the credit game. And the credit game is, well, we don't even want to talk about that right now. But I'm just going to tell you that that shouldn't matter, really. If I have a checking account, I couldn't have a checking account. They wouldn't give me a debit card. And then they have something called shared branches. And basically what that is, it's a collaborative of credit unions across the country that will allow you to draw money out of the credit account that you have in another state or another city or whatever. So I was going to close the account when I left Des Moines, Iowa, which is where I was. And they said to me, oh, you don't want to do that. They said, your money's here, and if you want to draw it out, all you have to do is go to a shared branch. And I said, oh, that sounds great. So I went to the shared branch. I had to call the credit union every time I wanted to draw money out and ask them to lift the restriction on my account so that I could pull my own money out of the account. And because of this restriction, anytime I deposited a check, it took 20 days to clear.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
and I was like,
serious float.
Yeah, no kidding. And I went to a credit union here in Denver area, and they said to me, just close that account and put all your money here. We'll give you a debit card. We won't restrict you here. They said that is the most and I tell people this and they go, wow, I have never heard of a credit union doing that sort of thing. And they said, just put your money here and we'll take care of it for you. And you know, you'll never have to ask permission to draw out your. And I'm like, are you serious? To draw out my own money, I have to call my mommy at the credit union and tell them that I want to draw some money out. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But anyway, go
Crazy.
Ahead.
Crazy.
Now tell us about the mortgage side of banking, because that's the one I'm a little confused on. Now, I've never taken a mortgage out on anything ever. Mm-hmm. So I know absolutely nothing about mortgaging. How does this work?
Same kind of thing as the article that you read on an individual depositor level, what the mortgage industry does so they can keep continuing to churn and use somebody else's money is after they write the same type of loan, like 30 loans that are the same type, and by same type, usually it's under a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac limit. So I don't know exactly in 2020 what the new limits are, but let's say for argument's sake, it's $750,000. So when they get to 30 of the same exact type of loans, let's say it's a fixed rate with a certain dollar amount that's under the maximum threshold, and it's a single family house or it's a condo, et cetera, it meets certain parameters, right? What they do then is sell those 30 loans on what's called the secondary market. So there are markets in New York, and investors buy those loans at a discounted rate. So let's say you're charging your borrower 4.5% interest to make that mortgage loan. The people in New York who buy it on secondary market might buy it at 4.25% interest, and the buyer then gets to keep the float, gets to keep that difference. Now, the advantage for the selling bank or the selling entity is that, hey, he or she gets to make more loans now because – that represents, say, 750,000 times 30 people. That represents a sizable amount of money. You can now write brand new mortgages to the new 30 people that are incoming. So that's how they make their money.
Yeah, and
so,
the whole point to remember.
The secondary market, when I was in the business, the number one secondary market was a little old company that none of us have heard of called GE. And you think, what's that got to do with mortgages? You know, don't they make light bulbs? Don't they make hospital equipment? Au contraire. No, they made a very sizable amount of their profit center was from the mortgage business and still continues to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's another aspect also of this mortgage business. The standard type of transaction is when you, the borrower, put down 20% of the full value of the home. So, you know, because everybody's credit strapped, not very many people have $100,000 lying around in cash in order to put 20%, right? So what happens is they make loans that exceed the 80%. It's called loan-to-value ratio. So maybe it's 85% or 90% of the home's value, or in some cases it's even 100%. That was another reason that lent itself to the 2008 crash. So they're making these loans with no skin in the game from the borrower. So the borrower, you know, if they can't make the payments, they just end up walking away. They don't care because they don't have $100,000 of their own cash invested into the property. So companies like GE and these secondary markets, they make money off of that too. And guess what? The interest rate on those loans, in other words, the loans that are from 80% to 100%, are at a way higher percentage because obviously it's more risk than the primary loan. So if the primary loan is at 4.5%, the second trust deed, it could be like 6% or 8% or, you know, depending on the person's credit. It's quite a bit more. So, you know, they don't care. They know all the actuarial statistics on this. They know when you're going to default. They know exactly it's going to take you 2.4 years to default. And they make all their money in the first 2 years. So if you default after that point in time, they're sitting fat and happy.
Right. Well, and now there's another facet to the banking industry, and we love to talk about this because this is probably one of my favorite things, my favorite subjects, the Federal Reserve. Now, several years ago when I first started my blog, one of the very first things I did was write the 26 biggest problems in this country, and one of the ones I wrote about was the Fed. Now, the Fed,
now, Christopher, you just went from a PG show about banking to triple X rated. You realize this,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, well, you know what? It's just very, very important to discuss this with America because America has no clue. These people have no clue.
That's right,
folks.
Back in the day
of 1933 or so, we had the big New Deal or the big Green Deal or whatever they wanted to call the Great New Deal, whatever the hell it was that Mr. Roosevelt brought in for us. Now, if you go way back in history, a lot of people don't realize this, but we've gone bankrupt many, many times in this country, and we have not owned our country since probably 1789 or better. But it really came to bear around the time that Mr. Roosevelt just said, okay, I want all of you people to give me your gold right now. And then they turned around, they gave that gold, they told us that they put all this gold in Fort Knox and they were going to hold on to it for us and someday they'd give it back to us. That's a bunch of crap, okay? Essentially what happened was, instead of going to the bank and turning in your bills for gold, which is the way you used to be able to do it, now you can go to the bank and you can turn in paper for more paper. And basically, it's not anything that's worth anything more than what you turned in. It's not worth anything. It's basically the only reason it means anything is because somebody somewhere said, this is worth $100. And it's not. It's not. And people don't understand how the whole thing works. And all that gold that they put in Fort Knox, allegedly, is missing. $66 billion in gold went missing from Fort Knox. This was back in, I can't even remember what date the article is. I used to have that on file, but it was written in the Globe, and it says 300 truckloads of bullion were simply driven away. And here's what the article said. Now, I want you to hear this because it's very entertaining. The Fed. Oh, yeah, this has got to be one of my favorite subjects. I remember I used to never know what the Fed was. As soon as I did, however, I knew it was bullshit. And Fort Knox, that magical place guarded by tens of thousands of magical soldiers that are under oath to guard with ferocity our national supply of the remaining gold we have. Oh, and our gold is not just held there. There's more that we can't verify we have either. Yes, another massive supply is being held at the Fed as well, allegedly. Fort Knox and the gold we have in reserve was audited last in 1953, folks. 1953. 80% of the gold in Fort Knox has since then disappeared overseas. And if you read up on the audit of 1953, the use of the word audit is pretty laughable. It was a best guess after the government appointed inspector, supposedly, formally tested less than 5% of that gold reserve and deemed it authentic. They wouldn't even let a non-government person in to inspect this gold. And basically what they went up to a couple of bars that they probably had lying in the front room, and they just scratched it and said, oh, yeah, it's gold, and a magical place indeed. I'm betting that same magic has made the gold that may have been there once magically disappear. Of course, we'll never know. There are no visitors allowed at the Fed or Fort Knox.
The only thing these so-called assessors were allowed to bring with them was a scale. So, in other words, if you take a block of gold, it's going to weigh exactly whether it's here or in Sweden or in Turkey or wherever you're measuring it. It's going to weigh the same exact number on the scale, right?
Yeah,
so you don't know if they've doctored the inside of that block. You know, yes, it might be the same exact weight, but they might have put another metal or object in there that's
or
making
cement,
that
or
block
God
of
knows
gold.
What else inside of it.
Right. Be fake. So they were not allowed to bring chemical testing. They were not allowed to do any sort of assaying. And you're right. They were only allowed to go through one little corridor. You know, of course, the Fort Knox has probably 10 floors, if not more, underground of all this so-called gold. They were not allowed to go anywhere. So the whole thing was a farce. Like, we know, it has zero gold left there.
They gave that gold away for interest on loans to us Americans a long time ago. The Fed, the central bank of the United States, is also magical. It produces American monies out of thin air. When we need more to spend, we just create more, fire up the presses. The president wants to spend $1 billion today, and we only have $500 million available. More magic than the Magic Kingdom at Disneyland. Now, here's what kills me. We have all this debt, trillions upon trillions, yet the Fed in 2008 was magically able to loan AIG Insurance Company $85 billion. One company to stave off bankruptcy? Why? So here are the things I'm forced to wonder. How can our central bank loan $85 billion to one company to stop it from going bankrupt, something that probably happens 1,000 times a day with other companies in the U.S., when our national debt is trillions of dollars large? By definition, then, I shouldn't worry about starting a business here when I'm near bankruptcy. It's okay. The Fed will come to my rescue, right? They've shelled out as much as $85 billion before. I should be fine. No one knows where this money comes from or why it wasn't used to pay off part of the national debt, but they did it. Magic, I tells you. Heck, the national debt gets too big, we can just borrow money from ourselves and fix it from the way it looks. And if that's not enough, we can just print up extras. No sweat. Now, guys, what I've got to say here is that government has a little trick that they've been pulling for a long time. They have two sets of books. They have one that's called the budget. The budget, by the way, is always in default. It's always in the red. It's always short, okay? And whenever they come to America, they just go, hey, here's our budget, and we're short. We need more money. We've got to raise taxes. Then they have another book, set of books. And this goes all the way from the president all the way down to your mayor, okay? They have another set of books that they call, are you ready? CAFRS. I say that really means coffers, because basically that's what it is. These people have stashed money away, and anytime they need more money, they just present the budget and say, well, this is the budget for this year, and we're not going to make it. So we need more money. We're going to have to charge more taxes. And then they have the coffers, which they have, or the CAFRS, if you want to call it that way. And they basically just stash all their money in there, every bit of money that, I mean, come on, you've been paying these people up to as much as 50% of your pay to these people since 1917. And by the way, the income tax, I'd like to get into that a little bit too. The income tax started in 1917 to pay off our debt of the war. Now, I myself never got involved in that war, and I don't know anybody else that got involved in it, but I do know that we shouldn't have had to pay for that, but we did. And for 2 years, they charged us a very low income tax. And that particular income tax was supposed to be temporary, and they were supposed to stop it in 2 years. Well, they did. And then the next year, they put it right back on the books and kept it there. And folks, you have been paying these people money and money and money, and they use that to start wars. They use that to build themselves more offices. They use that money to pay themselves. These people have used your money for years, and without your permission, without your consent, without your vote, they don't care, because money, I'll say it again, is illusory, folks. And any country that starts a paper currency and doesn't back it with anything loses, and we end up falling. Any great empire, you can look it up over the history of the world. Essentially, every time a country went to a paper currency, they folded. They folded. The whole thing went right down the tubes. And but what you have to remember is this is a system of control. It always has been. It always will be. Basically, what they're saying is you have to go out and work for us, slave for us, essentially. And when you slave for us, we'll give you your money. We'll take out the part that we want. And you just keep working at that low little wage there. And, you know, you talk about slavery, and all the black people are always talking about, oh, we were slaves and we worked for nothing. Well, that's basically what you're doing. They just switched it to from private slave ownership to public slave ownership. It's basically we're all slaves now, and it's been that way for a very long, long time.
Well, we're slaves, but the majority of the public today doesn't know that we're slaves, which is even harder to bear than, you know, chains.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
back
in the day, you know, I mean, because now they're doing it with, you know, biotechnology and radiation and the monetary system and debt and student loans and what's in your food and polluting the oceans. I mean, they're doing it in 100 fantastical ways. But
now,
you know,
I would like to go over the student loan.
You don't know that all roads lead to hell.
Well, yes,
I mean,
the average person
does not know how to connect all of these dots. But there's nothing, let me say this, there's nothing federal about the Federal Reserve. And three presidents have died over trying to overthrow the Federal Reserve. And the one president, Jackson, they tried to assassinate him, but they didn't succeed in killing him. But Garfield,
right,
they killed. Lincoln and JFK were all killed because why? They opposed the lunacy
of the
Federal Reserve.
Kennedy, but there were other ones.
There were other reasons on Kennedy. Kennedy became a president. He started out working for the system, but he became a president of the people, and they just didn't like that. So when they started doing things for the people, well, that was when they got rid of him. And there was another reason they got rid of him, too, and a lot of people don't know that, is because he was trying to disband the CIA. And the CIA said, well, no, that's not going to work out for you. And for those of you that don't believe it or don't know it, I'm sure that Mr. G.W. Bush had a lot to do with the murder of President Kennedy. I've looked deep into that particular story, and I see President G.W. Bush all over the place in that one. So, that was kind of a funny story. But we'll not try to go that route either, because we'll be here all day. But I really appreciate your coming on to tell us about that. And don't go away, because we're going to talk about some other things as well. Now, I would like to discuss the matter of digital currency. Now, folks, the New World Order does not mince words when it says exactly what it wants. And one of the things that it definitely wants is a one world currency. Now, what almost happened, and a lot of people don't know this, but what almost happened was China started buying up gold, and they started buying it up in bulk. And these people bought tons and tons and tons of gold. They were hoarding in China. Mm. And what they did was they tried to gather enough gold so that they could put out their own currency and destroy the U.S. dollar. But evidently that was not part of the plan, because it never happened. And there's a reason why it never happened that a lot of people don't understand where this came from. Digital currency, folks, Bitcoin came along, and all of a sudden Bitcoin was the big deal, and it still is a big deal. But there's another company that is also trying to put out their own digital currency. In case you don't know, that company is Facebook. And Facebook, we all know, is a very giant evil company. And Libra is their digital currency. They're saying that it will become the new currency. But it's essentially, it comes down to this, folks, that digital currency could be the next one world currency. And people don't understand that they want to get rid of the paper system. They want to get rid of it, but they also want to replace it with digital currency. And digital currency, to where people don't really understand it, is just a bunch of assets and debits. It's basically a computer screen telling you that you have so many credits, so many not credits. And you gotta understand what they want here. What they want here is a worldwide currency that can be controlled from one place, the computer, okay, the internet, the cloud, whatever you want to call it. It wants to be controlled from the cloud, and then basically your credit score becomes then your social credit score. And it people don't understand the credit system. The credit system is essentially a social credit score. It's basically, it enables you to get bigger loans. It enables you to get loans with less interest. It enables you to be basically a good American. It's a control system meant to make you a better person. So you go along with this whole little system that they've always had. And the thing that really pisses me off about credit scores is that in order to get a good credit score, you have to borrow money to get a good credit score, and you have to pay it off in payments. You can't go in there with all your cash and go, I want to pay this off right now. That will ruin your credit score. Does that make any sense to anybody? But evidently it does.
You pretty much have to.
They just do it anyway. Huh?
Yeah, you pretty much have to prove to the bank that you don't need their money. That's who gets the money.
Yeah, that's a good simple way of putting it. I like that. You're basically proving yourself to be financially independent.
Right. And that's why, you know, it's one reason why the rich get richer, is because you didn't need their money in the first place. If they said yes or no, it wasn't going to kill you, and you're still going to go ahead with your business transaction or whatever you're asking the loan for.
Right, right. And that's one thing I want to make it clear to people is that, you know, you can just save your own damn money and go out and buy what it is you need. I mean, that's what we all used to do, okay, before banks mm-hmm. came along. If we wanted something, we saved for it. I mean, that's not mm-hmm. hard. As far as keeping
right.
money in your home, well, gee, you know, there's all kinds of nifty little tricks that you can pull where you can, you can build a, I mean, there's people that have bank safes built into their outlets. There are people that have come up with all kinds of neat little tricks to keep their money at home. And I highly recommend it. I mean, I did it for 10 years. I don't know why I ever changed my mind, said I'll go to a credit union. I thought credit union would be better. It's really not that much better. But anyway, the point being is that you're always better off just keeping your money, because if you put it in the bank, you're going to lose it. You're going to lose it, and you're going to lose big. So I wouldn't suggest doing that at all. But yeah. Savings
right,
account.
So,
yeah, I can see that.
I'm not too familiar with the digital currency, but regular currency for depositors to the bank, there's something that's called FDIC insured. So what that means is if you put up to $250,000 in one singular bank, if for some reason that bank defaults and goes belly up, the government will pay you back the amount that you have deposited in that bank. So, you know, it's a protection. It's an insurance policy, right? So I don't know how they're managing the Bitcoins and the digital currency, because who's backing that up? I mean, like you said at the top of the program, they could tomorrow say, oh, your $100,000 is now worth, you know, $10.
And it's Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency. It's a decentralized digital currency without a central bank, which is a plus, or a single administrator. Yeah, but then there you have it. Single administrator. Who's the single administrator? And who's to say this guy won't yank it all? You know, I don't know.
Right.
But that it can be sent from user to user on a peer-to-peer Bitcoin network without the need for intermediaries, which would be, of course, banks. Now, here's the problem I have with Bitcoin. They're selling this as one Bitcoin equaling, I'm not kidding you, 10,423.90 United States dollars. That's what one Bitcoin evidently equals, which I really don't see how that's possible, but okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they're updated hourly. So it says at this point that one Bitcoin equals $10,423.90. Now, somebody told me there's a way to go out there and get free Bitcoins. And I'm like, okay. All right. Well, and then there's other data that shows that Bitcoin was the worst performing major cryptocurrency last week. So that means to tell me that that Bitcoin is one of hundreds of companies that are already doing this. And is it safe? Is it legal? We don't know about any of that stuff. We don't know that. There are risks of Bitcoins and that they are not legal tender. Bitcoins are still accepted by small business and merchants. Bitcoin is not regulated as it is not considered to be electronic money according to the law. So how in the world do we make that work? I don't know. It really confuses me as well.
If we have any listeners out there that who put any sort of security into Bitcoin or electronic banking,
yeah, God,
I would love to hear from them. Please call in.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine how anyone. Yeah.
We're going to have to make that possible because I have not given anybody my number. If there are people listening, please call in at 845-277-9424. Please don't let me be the only person, along with Linda Gross, of course,
talking about this, I would love to hear from anybody in the audience. And I would like all to also say, I've got somebody here who has definitely joined the chat room, but he finally left. I wasn't paying any attention, and there he was. But when one examines the legislation, it is indeed congressional, i.e. federal, ratified. No, I'm sorry, I don't. And this guy says, I often work in Switzerland. And here is wisdom. The root of crypto is crypt. Crypt is a place of the dead and buried. Aleph Lehman, thank you very much for your input there. Knowledge empowers you. I require investors for a German commercial endeavor. 10 will get you 20 in 24 months. And I don't know what that means. Au revoir et pay. It was evidently somebody that you know what? We got a caller. So this is good to know. Caller, if you're here listening and you have any knowledge about the banking system, cryptocurrency, any of those things, please press the number 1 on your phone and we will bring you in and you can definitely input on this subject. I would very much like to hear from somebody besides myself. So Linda, anything else you can tell us about banks and banking?
You know, for the listening audience, if they are all suspicious with, we're going to go to a one world currency, guess what they did in Europe? You know, up until just recently, all the European countries had their own currency, and now look at that. They all are unified with the euro. See?
Yeah.
So, they're gonna start off small, make sure the whole thing works, and then they'll just keep adding more and more countries, and, you know, you're going to have to pay to play.
Well, and this is what the transnational partnerships and all that stuff are about. Basically, they're trying to unify people on a continent, and then, of course, after they get done with the continents, then they make it, quarter, semi-quarter areas, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, the whole world. And it's all been a move to a one world government since the days of Karl Marx, and we all know that. Essentially, the whole ideal behind Karl Marx and behind socialism was we were going to make it so bad for everyone that everyone would unite under one banner and we could rule the world. Well, that's all real good and swell. But what happened instead was that everybody did gather together. They just gathered together under their own countries, and that screwed up the whole thing. But then they moved on to a more sinister approach, and they started a little thing that I like to call I had the phrase right on my tongue, and now I can't remember what it is. Cultural Marxism. Now, let me tell you how cultural Marxism works. Basically, we infiltrate you in other ways, like in your schooling, and also, of course, you know, and that's how they've got all these people that were so gung-ho about Hillary Clinton, and they were so gung-ho about socialism and progressivism. I'm sorry, I can't say the words today. And progressivism is just essentially, it's a socialist ideal. And essentially, they've been teaching these things to our kids for a long, long time. And these kids just come out completely different than the conservatives. And then next thing you know, we're giving away all our rights and we're going for control instead. And that's, you know, they once went to a college. I think it was Stanford, as a matter of fact. It was an Ivy League college. And essentially, they basically drew up a petition saying that we want to get rid of the First Amendment. Now, everyone that knows anything about the Constitution knows that the First Amendment is probably the defining amendment of our country. Freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom to redress government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They convinced 50,000 students at that college to sign the petition, or 5,000. They got 5,000 signatures to get rid of the First Amendment. Now, if that does not tell you that they have completely infiltrated the school system, nothing else does. I mean, I'm sorry, but how are you going to give away the most important right and the thing that gives you the single most freedom of any of the amendments, how are you just going to give that up with a signature? I don't know. But they did it as kind of a, it was kind of a wait and see kind of thing. They wanted to see if they could actually do it. And they got 5,000 students to sign that petition. And I was like, oh, that really just, it marks out how sad the country has become. But yeah, that's pretty sad day when we give away the Constitution.
Right, huh? That's some good brainwashing right there.
Oh, yeah. And that was one way. Then they did the sexual revolution and all this, you know, peace and love and screw as many people as you want to without having babies. I mean, all that stuff contributed to this. And basically what they did was they taught us from the inside how to destroy ourselves. And basically we've done a fine job. Divide and conquer. Hello. It's been an age old strategy for as long as we can remember.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you'd like to contribute, Miss Linda?
Well, on this subject, what do you think about this this term called resource-based economy? So what that means is that the writer of this type of economy says that we don't need currency at all. Why don't we just barter things? You know,
give me a bushel
of apples, and I will exchange that for some IT work or whatever. That everyone is in the bartering business, and you accumulate barter points, I guess. And we don't need
the
government
really,
thinking currency at all.
And really, for as long as history itself, they actually used that system, and it was a good system. The only problem is that people, you know, wanted to trade, say, you know, 20 blocks of cement. Well, they can't carry the 20 blocks of cement around in their pocket. So this is how the idea of currency actually started. But then there's currency and then there's money. And people don't understand what the difference is. Money is actually, according to the Constitution, can only be gold or silver. And gold and silver, of course, were in that time the two most valuable resources in the world. So therefore, when the Constitution was written up, gold and silver were the only two accepted currencies, and the only accepted money. Currency is a completely different animal. And for people that don't understand what currency is, it's just basically, quite simply put, is a representation of money. It's an illusory thing that people say, well, I've got 20 centipedes in my pocket, I'll trade you for 20 roaches and we'll call it a deal. This is an exchange system, and basically it has to be, if you're going to have a currency, you have to have it backed by something of value. And that's when we went wrong. We let what it is that backed our currency go to pot, and basically then it just became paper. And that's what it's been since the days of Nixon. When they abolished the gold standard, and that was done on command, by the way. It was done by the people at the banks. And so on. They just said, abolish that gold currency because we don't want your currency to be worth anything. We don't want your, you know, and that was by design. And a lot of people don't believe that or understand it. But essentially, once they took the gold and silver away from the dollar, it became worthless. And people don't understand that it's not the same dollar it was back in the 1960s. So it's important to believe
I'm sure there was a reason for it. I'll have to look it up and find out why they did what they did. Because it was working just fine for 200 years. Why take it away? So there must have been some kind of reason why they took it away. Maybe it was to print free money, you know. Like you say, you know, when in need, they got to, you know, make some new money for the war effort or whatever else they need to do, bail out the car companies or whatever else is going on.
It's hard to say, and it could have been any reason at all.
I could put that in real quick. Why did we abolish the gold standard? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
The gold standard. And according to here, why did the U.S. abandon the gold standard? To help combat the Great Depression, they said. Now, this is all bullcrap right here. This is a fluff article. The U.S. continued to allow foreign governments to exchange dollars for gold until 1971, when President Richard Nixon abruptly ended the practice to stop dollar-flush foreigners from sapping U.S. gold reserves, is what they're saying. I don't know. I just, that's a big pile of bull.
Wow.
Essentially, the gold standard was a monetary system that directly linked the currency's value to that of gold. A country on the gold standard cannot increase the amount of money in circulation without also increasing its gold reserves. Because the global gold supply grows only so slowly, being on the gold standard basically would theoretically hold government overspending and inflation in check. So I think that pretty much answers my question. It holds government overspending and inflation in check. We can't have that. No country currently backs its currency with gold, but many have in the past, including the U.S. For half a century, beginning in 1879, Americans could trade in $20.67 for an ounce of gold. The country effectively abandoned the gold standard in 1933 and completely severed the link between the dollar and the gold in 1971. The U.S. now has a fiat money system, meaning the dollar's value is not linked to any specific assets. They abandoned the gold standard, it says here, to help combat the Great Depression. Faced with mounting unemployment and spiraling deflation in the early 30s, the U.S. government found it could do little to stimulate the economy. To deter people from cashing in deposits and depleting the gold supply, they didn't want people cashing in their money for gold, because that would mean that they'd have no gold. Oh, my God. So in 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt cut dollars ties with gold, allowing the government to pump money into the economy and lower interest rates. So, you know, that's the official narrative. And in my opinion, the whole deal went because we went bankrupt. We went bankrupt, and they had to get they conspired with the bankers of the world, and they basically said, okay, well, we've got a deal for you. You go collect up all the gold, and we'll issue you a paper currency that you can say is worth gold or whatever, and then that will appease them and you know, and so on and so forth. But at that time, and a lot of people don't realize that, because of that bankruptcy and because of that gold collection, and by the way, just so you know, the people of that day were forced to give up their gold. They actually sent the FBI around with guns and forced people at gunpoint to give up their gold. And a lot of people don't realize that. They don't know that that happened. Essentially, we became the enemy of the people, and a lot of people don't, or the enemy, period, of government. And and in case you doubt that, I'm just going to tell you that I have a segment from Black's Law Dictionary, fourth edition. Hang on just a second. I'm trying to find it right now. I've got it right on my blog. Hang on just one second. This is very, very important that you know this. Because people wonder why it is that it seemed like government doesn't do anything for us. Well, it's obvious why they don't do anything for us, because they did the wrong thing. And people, yeah, here it is right here. Here it is. It says right here, this is Black's sixth edition. It says the military, pertaining to war or to the army concerned with war. Black's sixth edition, see note. And what it says here is, note, the Amendatory Act to the Trading with the Enemy Act of October 6, 1917, namely the Emergency Banking Relief Act of March 9, 1933, defined the American people as the enemy legally of the United States government because of the U.S. bankruptcy, through which the private international Federal Reserve System became the government, the creditor of the United States. See ramifications of the bankruptcy, the nature of Federal Reserve notes in appendix. How do you like that?
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
we are
big.
The enemy of the people, and we are the enemy of government because the private bankers are our government. People don't understand that. The government is not the government. The government is the banking system.
Yeah. Well, it's like the old rule, right? The golden rule. He who has the gold gets to make the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was in effect, you know, thousands of years ago. Guess what, listening audience? That's absolutely 1,000% in effect today. It's more true today than it's ever been.
Absolutely.
And
I'm going to say
here's another
again.
Thing.
Go ahead.
Here's another thing that I like to scratch my head on. If something doesn't make sense, call it the Kobe crash or coronavirus or, you know, the default of this major company or whatever it is. If something doesn't make sense to you, my advice is follow the money.
Yeah, thank you very
follow
much. And I
money.
Said that about 20 different times last night.
who benefited from that event taking place? Because that's where you need to look. That's a good place.
Yeah.
Because
absolutely.
They're, like you say, it's all in plain view. You just got to look for it.
Yep, exactly. And that's where you can find the answer to just about everything. All you got to do is follow that paycheck. You follow that paycheck and you'll find out what's going on. I'm very much a firm believer in that. I'm going to say this again because I have to. We have a guest call-in number. It's 845-277-9424. Let me say that again because I know you didn't get your pencil in time. 845-277-9424. We have one caller that is not a speaker. And if you would like to speak this evening, I insist that you press the number one on your phone. You are more than welcome to speak to us tonight. You can talk to Linda. You can talk to me. Oh, nobody wants to talk to me. But you can text her and talk to our guest, Linda. If you have anything to say at all, please press the number one. I'll know that you're not just a listener, you're a speaker as well. So, and we'll stay right here with you. We'll make sure we'll hold your hand right through the whole thing. If you don't feel like you're a good speaker, that's fine. But, so it's very important for people to realize that, we have not been our own country for a very, very long time. And I would like to, also read to you a little segment from, now, several years ago, this was back in 2015, I believe it was. In 2015, a judge who decided that she'd had about enough of the system that we're in right now, she'd had enough of conning people. She'd had enough of basically everything. She'd had enough of everything. And she finally came right out and told everybody what was really going on. And now, of course, this person has been massively discredited. They made her sound like an absolute Looney Tune. They did a fine, fine job of making her sound like an absolute nutcase. But she basically just got fed up with the whole thing and said, look, I'm just going to tell everybody what's really going on here and what has really happened in our history. I think it's extremely important that people hear this because if they don't hear it, they don't understand it. And they've completely hijacked everything, folks. The judiciary, the banking system, the money, everything has been kidnapped. Everything has been turned to their way of doing things and their way of thinking. And until you actually hear it in black and white, you're never going to understand it. And this is a long letter, but I'm going to try and shorten it up a little bit because she does do a little bit of repeating. But this particular person is well known, and she was a Supreme Court justice in Alaska. Her name was, I believe she had two different names that she kind of went by. One was... hang on, I'm trying to find her name now. Here it is, right here. It's very important that you hear this. This is the death of the justum, the legal mafia system. Here we go. We're getting there. We're getting there. There it is right here. This is Justice. I'm trying to think of her name. There it is. Anna Reitzinger or Van Reitz, I believe was her real name. But she basically filed a $279 trillion lawsuit against the U.S. government and told people exactly what happened. And I think it's important that you hear this. And Linda, I'm sorry, I'm just going to take over for a minute here. This is a letter she wrote. Alaska, dear federal agents. This was from Big Lake, Alaska, 2015, November. I'm addressing this letter in this way because it's my understanding that it will be read by members of both the FBI and the U.S. Marshals Service. It is also my understanding that you have available for examination a wet ink signed a copy of the illustrated affidavit of probable cause entitled "You Know Something Is Wrong When," an American affidavit of probable cause as backup reference and evidence. Since the publication of the affidavit, a plethora of new supporting documentation and evidence has come to light. We found, for example, that on June 30th, 1864, the members of Congress, acting as the board of directors of a private, mostly foreign-owned corporation doing business as the United States of America Incorporated, changed the meaning of state, small letter, state capital letter, and United States to mean District of Columbia Municipal Corporation. Like the 1862 change of the meaning of the word person to mean corporation, cited in our affidavit, these special coded meanings of words render a drastically different picture of the world around us. It turns out that your personal bank account is actually a corporate bank account. The Colorado State Court is actually the Colorado District of Columbia Municipal Corporation Court. If you are shocked to learn these facts, you are not alone. So are millions of other Americans. These changes were made 150 years ago and tucked away in reams of boring meeting minutes and legalistic gobbledygook, meant to be applied only to the internal workings of a private governmental services corporation and its employees. There was no public announcement, just as there was no public announcement or explanation when Congress created municipal citizenship, known as U.S. citizenship, in 1868. Properly, technically, even to this day, this form of citizenship applies only to those born in the District of Columbia, Guam, Puerto Rico, and other insular states, so there was no real reason to educate the general public about the topic. As Congress was secretively using the labor and the private property assets of these citizens as collateral backing the corporate debts of the United States of America, Inc., there was plenty of reason to obscure that particular development. At the end of the Civil War, it would have been very unpopular to reveal that they were simply changing gears from private sector slave ownership to public sector slave ownership. You may be surprised to learn that slavery was not abolished by the 13th or any other amendment to any constitution then or now. Instead, slavery was redefined as the punishment meted out to criminals. Look it up and read it for yourselves. It remains perfectly legal to enslave criminals, and it was left to Congress to define who the criminals were. Because Congress was given plenary power over the District of Columbia and its citizenry by the original Constitution of the Republic and could do whatever it liked within the district and the Washington, D.C. municipalities. This is where it gets good. A child picking dandelions on the sidewalk could be arbitrarily defined as a criminal and enslaved for life by the renegade Congress functioning as the government of the District of Columbia and as the board of directors for the District of Columbia Municipal Corporation. But for starters, Congress simply defined U.S. citizens as debt slaves under the 14th Amendment of their corporation's articles and bylaws, which they deceptively named, and look this one up for yourself, the Constitution of the United States of America. The actual Constitution was and still is called the Constitution for the United States of America, small u. But most people untrained in the law and trusting what they believed to be their government
didn't notice the difference between the Constitution for the United States of America and the Constitution of the United States of America. Are you beginning to see a pattern of deliberate deceit and self-interest and doublespeak and double dealing? Are you also beginning to catch the drift, the motivation behind it? Let's discuss the concept of hypothecation of debt. This little gem was developed by the bankers who actually owned and ran the Governmental Services Corporation, doing business as the United States of America, Inc., and as the United States Incorporated. When you hypothecate debt against someone or against some asset belonging to someone else, you simply claim that they agreed to stand as surety for your debt, similar to co-signing a car loan. And as long as you make your payments, nobody is the wiser. Normally, it's not possible for us to just arbitrarily claim that somebody is our surety for debt without proof of consent, but that is exactly what Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Conference of Governors did in March of 1933. They named all of us and our property as surety standing good for the debts of their own bankrupt governmental services corporation during bankruptcy reorganization, and got away with it by claiming that they were our representatives and that we had delegated our authority to them to do this for us. The exact date and occasion when this happened and where it is recorded is given in our affidavit. In order to pull this off, however, they had to allege that we were all U.S. citizens and therefore all subject to the plenary power of Congress acting as an oligarchy ruling over the District of Columbia and the federal territories. They did this by abusing the public trust and creating and registering millions of foreign situs trusts named after each of us. Under their own diversity of citizenship rules, corporations are considered to be U.S. citizens. So they created all these foreign situs trusts as franchises of their own bankrupt corporation, used our names styled like this, John Quincy Adams, and placed commercial liens against our names as chattel owned by their corporation and standing as surety for its debts. That, by the way, folks, means that you, yourself, your children, and everything that you own is part of the property of the Corporation of the United States of America, Inc. A group of thugs elected to political office grossly transgressed against the American people and the American states and committed the crime of personage against each and every one of us without us ever being aware of it. They couldn't enslave us, but they could enslave a foreign situs trust named after us. That's our names, by the way, that we conveniently didn't know existed. And by deliberately confusing this thing with us via the misuse of our given names, they could bring charges against what appeared to be us and our private property in their very own corporate tribunals. And so the fleecing of America began in earnest. The hirelings had our credit cards, had stolen our identities, and were ready to begin a crime spree unheralded in human history. They claimed that we all knew about this arrangement and consented to it because we voluntarily gave up our gold when FDR sent his henchmen around to collect it. When, as millions of Americans can attest, people gave up their gold in preference of being shot or having to kill federal agents. They chose life for everyone concerned over some pieces of metal. And for that, they are to be honored. Fortunately, their decision gave the rats responsible an excuse to claim that Americans wanted to leave the gold standard and wanted the benefits of this new deal in equitable exchange for their gold, their identities, the abuse of their good names as bankrupts and debtors, the loss of allodial title to their land and homes, and their subjection as slaves to the whims of Congress. According to them, that is, those who benefited from this gross betrayal of the public trust, we all voluntarily left the Republic of the United States of America and the guarantees of the actual Constitution behind, willingly subjected ourselves to congressional rule, donated all our assets, including our labor and property, to the public charitable trust set up after the Civil War as a welfare trust for displaced plantation slaves, and agreed to live as slaves owned by the District of Columbia Municipal Corporation in exchange for what? Welfare that we paid for ourselves. Social Security that we paid for ourselves. The criminality of the U.S. Congress and the President's
acting since 1933 is jaw-droppingly shocking. Their abuse of the trust of the American people is even worse. They have portrayed this circumstance as a political choice instead of an institutionalized fraud scheme, and they have presumed, and I'm sure you guys have heard the words presumed and assumed, that we all went along with it and agreed to do it without complaint. Thus, they have been merrily and secretively having us declared civilly dead as American state citizens the day we are born and entering a false registration claiming that we are U.S. citizens instead. We are told when we wake up enough to ask that we are free to choose our political status. We don't have to serve as debt slaves. We can go back and reclaim our guaranteed Republican form of government and our birthright status if we want to. But that requires a secret process in front of the probate court and expatriation from the federal United States to the continental United States and all sorts of voodoo and back rooms that can only be perused or pursued by the few and the knowledgeable and the blessed. Everybody else has to remain as a debt slave and chattel, serving whatever corporation bought the latest version of corporate persona named after us. So I tell you that some of you are probably belong to some little guy in China right now. you know, this is, you know, people just do not understand the depth of the fraud that has been perpetrated against us for 150 years, folks. And every time that you go before a judge, I've actually heard a judge speak this out of his mouth. And they said, the Constitution doesn't apply to you. What? The Constitution doesn't protect me? Really? Why? Because you're just a piece of property, folks. You are a piece of property, and those judges can do whatever they damn well feel like to you. Your children belong to them. Your money belongs to them. Your private property belongs to them. You don't own your property. I've said this many times. You do not own your property. That land can be taken away from you for the amount of taxes you owe the government. But you don't have to pay that because you don't deal in real estate, because that's what you're doing when you buy a house. You're engaging in the practice of real estate. You are not buying private property. And people just don't get that. Okay, yeah. I think I'm done. Do things make a little more sense to you now?
I think we should all go to law school so we can understand the difference between the capital U and the small U and all these crazy little things.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're going to tweak the language to where it best serves them.
People do not get that there are two constitutions in this country. The first one was suspended, and it was suspended back after the Civil War. The whole purpose of the incorporation, by the way, was because they had seceded from the Union. The states of Texas and all the southern states had seceded from the Union for the Civil War, and they couldn't bring them back unless they incorporated. So they incorporated, and then they found out that once they had done that, they could get away with all kinds of shit, and they did. And they have, and they will continue to do so until we figure out what's going on.
Very clever.
Yeah, I thought it was. Okay, we have another caller that has entered the building. That person may just want to listen, and that's cool. I can handle that. If you've got anything to say, though, you are more than welcome to press the number one. We will bring you in, whether you like it or not. But other than that, I'll just assume that you're just listening and you just want to pay attention. And believe me, I look up these area codes every time I see them. I want to make sure that this isn't somebody from government.
Yeah.
Well, this person is from Minnesota, so they're okay. Anyway.
Okay.
I like that. But, yeah, so you guys
have to. You're going to turn down a 202 area code? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Oh, believe me, they have ways of bouncing off those and getting to other area codes.
Yeah.
So, hey, it could be that this person is from Washington, D.C. They've just used a VOIP and bounced themselves over to Minnesota.
Yeah, they made some fake-a-rooney, you know, prefix that is in Minnesota or wherever they want you to think they're calling from.
Yep, yep. And let me make it clear, you are talking to Christopher Bruce. That's C-H-R-I-S-T-O-P-H-E-R-B-R-U-C. Son of a bitches, I'm coming for you. So anyway, and by the way, we have Linda Gross. Yeah, make sure you write that number down. She's a domestic terrorist. And so...
Can I
just thought I'd get that one
plug
in there.
Thank you. Let me squeeze in a quick plug. The
go
name of
California.
The
go
name,
get her. Anyway.
Yeah. What? Let me squeeze in a plug. All right. So people should listen to my show also right here on Blog Talk Radio. All you got to do is Google it if you're not already on my show. The Men's Advocate Show with Linda Gross. The Men's Advocate Show with Linda Gross. And then head on over to Amazon and buy my books on Amazon, The Science of Mastering Women. The Science of Mastering Women. And also have a book for the ladies, too. It's called Hitched in 90 Days, What You Need to Do to Get Him to Propose in 90 Days. Simple as that.
Oh, my God. I cannot believe I'm listening to this. Anyway, yeah. So, or you can just figure it out for yourselves. Anyway, no, I'm just kidding, Linda. I have been on Linda Gross's show. This was only fair that I drag her over here and give her a hard time because she drugged me onto her show and started talking about her books and all that stuff too. And then we talked about 5G, and that's always been one of my main subjects of late because I have the feeling that they're trying to reset humanity, but neither here nor there. We're not going to talk about that tonight either. But it's been a very interesting conversation. I think we did well. And I'm going to cut it a little short. I have something to do, but I wanted to thank Linda Gross for coming on and speaking just a little bit while I spoke most of the time. And I appreciate your input. And I would very much think that we could probably do this again about another subject that we have in common. But we'll get back to that at some other point in time, shall we not?
Absolutely. This was big fun, and we'll do it again soon.
That sounds wonderful. Now, I want to check the chat room real quick before I left. I wanted to make sure. No, nobody else wanted to show up, so that's cool. It's cool. I can handle that. But this will get shared around. This will get become one of my better shows, I'm sure. I wanted to express that sometime, and I do believe this will happen on Sunday. I wanted to make this announcement. Sunday, we're going to have Mr. Maxwell Egan. And for you people that do not know who Maxwell Egan is, I insist that you go to YouTube, put in Everything is a Lie, Max Egan, and you will definitely be hooked after that show. I guarantee it. Mr. Maxwell Egan, I believe, is one of the more valuable thinkers of our day and age. And Mr. Egan will be joining us on Sunday. This will not be a call-in show, by the way. You will not be able to call and talk or ask any questions. Unfortunately, he is in Australia, which means he's opposite my schedule. We're going to record the show and upload it, but I guarantee you will still enjoy it. Please join us Sunday for that show. Next week, we're also going to have another vaccine show. But this one is going to be a little bit different because I'm going to be bringing on some heavy hitters in the anti-vax movement, and we're going to definitely be discussing what that's all about. So this is going to be an interesting week for me, and I'm hoping for you too, and that you will definitely make some draws in. So thank you very much, everybody, for showing up. This is Christopher Bruce with America's Deadly Sins, The Living Man, and thank you very much for showing up this evening. Come back
this is
again
Aldous
tomorrow.
Huxley, a man haunted by a vision of hell on earth. A searing social critic, Mr. Huxley, 27 years ago, wrote Brave New World, a novel that predicted that someday the entire world would live under a frightful dictatorship. You'll find out why in a moment.
Wage of renegade machines, the child of the new world and fascist regimes. Remnants of the Third Reich lurk behind the scenes, training all the puppets and then pulling on their strings. It's a dark, dark circus with a serpent man, a king, feeding on the energy of creatures in the kingdom, on the people and the cattle and the fishes and the sheep. Daily mass genocide while most of the people sleep. It's a cold-blooded, murderous, money-hungry beast, creeping through the tapestry of everything we see, from the schools to the hospitals, the malls and the screens at the supermarket. market, on the covers of the magazines, from the EMS, every day raining on our brains, from the GMOs, tailored to affect our DNA, and the DSM criteria to diagnose your state, and the drugs and the water meant to keep us all sedated. So well-planned kill man, never gonna give a damn, murder off a whole race quick just to claim land, no shame, old game, propaganda campaign, tricking you to pick a side when it's all the same thing. Red team, blue team, ready, set, go. Muhammad seems both, they're under the same control. Big money, blood money, brotherhood ties, an empire built upon lies, lies. We're rising from the ashes to cut through the facades, never bowing down to the self-appointed gods, stepping to their armies against all odds, and this tidal wave of revolution will not be stopped. The preordained sure thing happening right now, coming from the kingdom and the kingdom's coming down. It's about time, wake minds, never gonna take mine, all about peace, but make no mistake, I, when assaulted by something else, don't hesitate to act and defend myself. I don't wait for any signal except inside me, and I'm grateful that I listen to these. Cause it's a well-planned kill, man, never gonna give a damn.